what we set out to do in creating a museum that really belonged to the city, that belonged to everybody who passed by it, who walked over it, who went inside it, that created a new sense of place and destination.
At Building Pictures, we believe in the power of public space to create better cities. And this is our podcast, No País dos Arquitetos, in the country of architects, a territory where architectural conversations are an opportunity to get to know the architects, the projects, and the stories behind the great Portuguese architecture. My name is Sara Nunes, and today we will talk with Amanda Levite about the Met in Lisbon, Portugal. This podcast is sponsored by Pressram Group. Welcome to the podcast, Amanda.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's lovely to see you here.
I am quite excited to do this interview because, as I was telling you in off, I was in inauguration day at MAT, the Museum of Art and Architecture and Technology, and I was not the only one who was excited about that day. A lot of people from the city come to visit this building. I think Lisbon City all want to know what is inside this building and around. So why do you think people were so curious about?
I think what's so extraordinary and really special about the MAT and how it came about is, first of all, it's a great kind of philanthropic gift from a privately owned utility company. Secondly, at the time it opened in 2016, Lisbon was going through a kind of renaissance. And that renaissance, you have to remember, it came out, and you will know better than me, out of a period of great austerity, which made it all the more special and poignant. And right from the very start, this project had huge political support. And that is not always the case in many countries. And I think that was a huge contributor. And it meant that by the time the building opened, there was a really a great expectation that an expectation of a building that would go beyond its boundaries. And in a sense, that is what we set out to do, because the site is one of the most kind of spectacular geographies. It's on the westernmost peninsula of Europe. It faces south. It's that moment where you can literally, in the water, you can see where the river becomes the sea, the change in the pattern of the water. And there's something, I came to understand from, many visits to Lisbon that there's something very special about the city and its people, and I think it's partly to do with the geography, because there's a very outward-looking aspect to the people and to the culture. And it's not just about looking back into Europe, it's looking out to South America, to Africa, it's from where the great explorers set off. There's this sense of discovery, expectation. And when I first started talking with Antonio Mejia, the CEO of EDP, who was our client, he talked about it as he wanted to create a place that was not about the past, but it was about the present and the future, and that it was about exploring and experimenting. In our very early conversations, I also talked about how important it is today to see buildings not just as an architectural set piece, but as an urban proposition, and to really root them in their place and to make them belong to their place. And the way in which you do that is to kind of think beyond the outline of the site and think about the wider impact a building can have. But what was incredibly clear from the first time I was, you know, walking along the riverfront, this extraordinary riverfront, where there's been a lot of investment over the years to really kind of reinvent it and animate it. But the riverfront was cut off from the rest of the city by a four-lane highway and the railway tracks. And this was a huge problem. And so people were queuing on bridges. In fact, what was interesting, on the opening weekend, this was before our bridge was open, and I will come back to that, but the bridge was so full of people, they had to actually close it because it was in danger of collapse. But then, you know, back to your question, why did it ignite people's imagination? So our very first move, if you like, was to try and grapple with the kind of paradox of this incredible riverside location that was cut off from the rest of the city. And how could we, through kind of urban thinking, through design, how could a building help reconcile that? So we argued right from the beginning that for this building to become successful and to be really accessible to people, we had to design another bridge that would directly land on the roof of the building. And we actually identified a small square on the other side of the railway tracks where we spanned from that point to the roof without steps in a kind of sweeping curve that was structurally strong. And that move, that kind of curvature, that sweep was the generator for the whole geometry of the building. So this idea that you can, because, you know, Lisbon as a city, it's incredibly difficult to get around if you're elderly, if you're with prams, if you're disabled, because, you know, it's the city of the seven hills. And it's wonderful and beautiful because of that, but it makes it a challenge. So we provided an incredibly easy kind of intuitive route to get there. And having made that move, the roof then becomes a kind of elevated town square. And what is kind of powerful about it, I think, is that not only do you have a fabulous view across the other side of the river, but you can turn around and look back and have a perspective of Lisbon that you've never seen before. So you have this kind of literal and metaphorical connection and relationship between the old city, between the palace, and between the riverfront. And so this elevated town square becomes a natural place to be, a destination point, a place where you meet people, you hang out. And then beyond that, we, you know, once you're on the roof, you can either take the ramp or some steps, gentle steps down to the riverfront. And along the riverfront, we really, you know, again, to root this building in place, we wanted to have a sort of visceral response to the water, to the shoreline. So we took the marble steps down into the water. So at high tide, they flood. And it means that you can, when a hot day, and there are many hot sunny days in Lisbon, you can sit on the steps, put your feet in the water, and there's this, you know, it just a very sensual response to the place. And I think it's that really ignited people's imagination, because it's more than a building. It becomes a place. Sure. It becomes a place.
And, yeah, you made it a place.
And you don't have to go to the building. You don't have to go and see an exhibition. You don't, you know, it's an incredibly democratic way of inviting people into a museum.
It's amazing. You keep speaking about this project. The listeners cannot see your face, Amanda, but you speak with so much passion about this, not just this building, but this idea that the building actually allowed people to meet, connect parts of the city. So give much more than just a museum to see art pieces. That's already a good goal,
yeah.
You know. And I really feel that you achieve that, because every time that I go to Matt, you can see a lot of people, families, you can see people running, cycling on the stairs close to this to the river, like you said. You can actually see a lot of boats going and come back as well. And even on the top of the roof, you can see a lot of people with wheelchairs, with a babies. So that's quite a live space. Yeah.
And I think, you know, if there's never really been a more important time to create spaces where people can come together. You know, where people can just be with other people. You don't have to talk. You don't have to engage. You might not. You know, there's a huge resurgence in festivals, in music festivals, in literary festivals. People love to be with other people who have a kind of shared sensibility, who bring new perspectives, where you can just be alongside people from all generations, from, you know, different continents. It's so important. And you feel when you're outside, I think you always feel freer than when you're inside.
Now let's enter into the building. And can you explain how this project works inside? I feel like this flow that you have outside, you keep it inside. Can you explain?
Yeah, and that was very important. I mean, we did something that I would say is quite counterintuitive and quite unusual for an architect. So we did not actually build as high as the code would have allowed us to. That was for two reasons. First of all, we didn't want to pose any kind of challenge to the power station, which is a great piece of industrial architecture and really kind of powerful, masculine building.
With these bricks.
Yes, and these kind of reddish bricks and really, really beautiful. And it is obviously now part of the kind of the Kunsthal, the campus, the art campus. But it was also having made this move about, you know, can a building help reconcile a city that's cut off from its waterfront? We wanted to make sure that when you were on the other side of the river, your view of the city was not impeded by the museum. And likewise, when you're in the old part of the city, your view is not impeded by the building as you look towards the river. So that meant that for some of the gallery spaces, we went below the water table.
So you have to dig.
We went below the water table level. And that has its technical challenges. And so, you know, it's unusual to enter a museum and then go down. You know, it's, so that is what you do. You enter the museum, there's the kind of entrance hall, the greeting, there's the shop, there's the restaurant on the waterfront. But then to get to the galleries, you start to go down. And like this very kind of gentle sweep of the roof, to go down, you have a very gentle, gently graded ramp around the outside of this huge oval space. And this oval space, which is the kind of the central space, if you like, of the museum, is for big art. You know, it's for big ideas, big art. It's a very big space. It's very adaptable. It's quite tough. The ceiling is exposed. It's technical. But it has this kind of softness because of its oval shape. So the ramp and some stairs to take you around the outside of the space.
Yeah, it's true. It's quite big, but somehow you feel embraced by the space.
Yes, that's right. And then, you know, there have been some fantastic installations in that space.
Do you have a favourite one?
Well, one of my favourite pieces was the installation in the Oval Gallery by Hector Zamora.
Oh, okay.
That I thought was a beautiful kind of use of the space, both kind of volumetrically and you can see people gathering around the perimeter on the ramps, on the stairs, looking down at this kind of the chaos of the shipwreck, if you like. But just to continue, so have, you know, that is a space that can be for installations for a kind of one-off installation. And then you're led into the other galleries. And because this is a museum where disciplines come together, so it's for art, architecture and technology, this idea that one space fluidly leads into another, that the circulation between the galleries becomes a part of the experience, and that the boundary, if you like, between gallery and circulation is deliberately blurred. And so one space fluidly feeds into the next. And there you have spaces that are different in scale. There's one space that is illuminated by a roof light where we designed the geometry that it would only let in north light, but not the strong southern light. And from underneath, you can look up through the roof light and see the sky and see the overhang of the ceramic tiles that create the shade for the outside space on the steps. And again, that's about, you know, rooting the building in its place to have, because when you descend, when you go below ground,
it can be the sense of
it's
the space,
disorientating. Yeah. And you want to know where you are in relation to the water, where you are in relation to the riverfront. So that was important.
It's funny, now that you are explaining me this, I'm thinking about, for instance, in Serralves with Cisa, you have these windows that also you can see to the garden. So you also have these moments that makes you relate with the space and where you are.
We interrupt this episode to talk with engineer Ávila Souza from the Pressroom Group that will share useful information to the architects that listen to this podcast about the MAD building.
This project was built using gypsum boards from Gyptec. Gypsum boards, plaster boards, drywall are different names for this kind of solutions that we can build, and we can achieve round walls or square walls or rectangle walls, whatever we need. In this kind of project, the architect has a feeling that she wanted the interior to go along with the exterior, to that fluidity of movements, that round walls that embrace us when we enter the building. That was a very important aspect that we could achieve with the plasterboard systems from Gyptec. Other property that was very important in this kind of building, it was the fire properties, the fire-resistant properties of the walls, that should protect the metallic structure that holds the building. So we have two different aspects here, the aesthetic and the fire properties. Other aspects very important in this kind of public buildings are acoustic properties, are the comfort, the thermal comfort properties, and the mechanical properties as well, security. So we have a range of different aspects that drywall systems from Gyptec can provide to this kind of buildings, to this kind of projects. Another interesting aspect of this material, it was that gypsum boards from Gyptec were produced with the leftovers of the power, the coal power plants from EDP, the owner of the building. So we built this building with leftovers of their own production. It's closing the loop. This reflects our mission, the mission of our group, to make products that are sustainable.
I was thinking as well, when you were explaining the main gallery, that the museum has this ability to first you watch, then you participate. Mm-hmm. Maybe because of art as well that was exposed there, that has this sense of see, but also be part of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe because of the scale. Even.
Yeah. Well, it was very interesting. The first installation was Dominique Gonzalez Foster, and she used the space to create a kind of an enclosure, a cage, if you like, for the public. So the public became the protagonists. And that was a really interesting way of dealing with the space. But one of my favorite exhibitions where an artist took the entire building was the Carsten Holler, because he, first of all, he used only light from his pieces. So none of the artificial lights were on. And so there was this kind of flow of light energy, which was almost as though it was a reflecting the lines, the kind of flowing lines of the building. It was a really extraordinary response, very poetic.
I think it must be very interesting for an architect that imagine a space for possibilities, but in the end ends up being surprised by how...
But that's, yes, that's so important. And, you know, some of the best things that happen or have happened there, we didn't design. They were almost kind of accidental. So one was we discovered that when you stand at the top of the steps in the middle of the building with the overhang of the tiles above you, and if you close your eyes, what you hear is the sound of the waves bounces onto the underside of the overhang.
And it's quite loud. You are saying this, but it's
really
quite loud.
And that the sound of the waves is not coming from below the water, it's coming from above. And that's a kind of magic moment. And I wish I could say we'd designed it purposely, but we didn't. But it's something that we'll remember for next time. But there was another event where a group of musicians, Portuguese musicians, and honestly, you couldn't have imagined this, and it's so beautiful. They used the building, because it's a very long facade with these ceramic tiles, they used it as a musical instrument. And you know, that is what I think, for me, those kind of unexpected moments where artists or the public appropriate the building in ways that you didn't imagine, for me, that's a kind of real measure of success.
Yeah, it's a museum that keeps inspiring people to be creative and to develop their art. This building you were mentioning about the ceramic tiles. Can you explain a bit more how this facade works?
So one of the kind of great inspirations, if you like, for the building was the craftsmanship that you find in Portugal. First of all, the calçada pavements, beautiful marble cobbles, absolutely extraordinary, beautiful. And then the fantastic blue and white glazed tiles that you see everywhere on a bar, on a church, and this rich tradition of ceramics. And what we wanted to do with the facade, which is extremely long, was twofold. One is to give it a kind of human grain, break down the scale, give it a kind of a texture. And the other was to use the building as a kind of foil to reflect the light, because the light that you get in that southern western location is so extraordinary and so golden.
And that's the perfect spot, by the way, to watch the sunset.
The sunset, to be on the roof and to watch the sunset is just magical there. And we wanted to, you know, use the tradition of ceramics, but to give it another layer. And if we're using the building as a foil to capture the light, we wanted to have maximum number of surfaces. So we designed these three-dimensional tiles where the angle changes, but you also get the exposure of the edge of the tiles. So you've got multiple angles that pick up the sun. And the most, you know, at dusk, the building almost appears to be made of pewter. At sunset, it literally is as though the building has caught on fire. It's completely golden. So we
and sometimes on the bottom of the day it's white.
And so then it's just white on a cloudy
day. Or sometimes a bit blue in the morning.
We really worked very hard to kind of, you know, when we started we thought, oh, you know, we play with maybe different coloured glazes. And then we realised, no, you know, this, you've got to let the sun do its magic, to let the light do its magic. That's where the colour comes from. So we chose this very neutral glaze, and then added a kind of crackle glaze to the finished tile. And that's really a reference to kind of 16th century Song Dynasty when through an accident in the kiln, this effect of kind of crackle glazing was a fault, but it was discovered. And then the artisans began to figure out how to replicate that because it was so beautiful, this sort of very fragile crackle. And it just means that when you go close up to the building, there's this other layer. You can't perceive it from a distance.
From far, you cannot see it, no. It's, you know what I think is amazing? Is before I start to dig in and study more about this project, I thought that the way the facade reacts to light was like an accident and not thought before. So I thought let's just choose tiles because they have this connection with Portugal. Mm-hmm. I thought that was this. And I think it's amazing that, for instance, your rendering image, the way the sun goes through the facade is quite similar to what happens mm-hmm. now. So this study about light in the facade, I think it's quite amazing. Sometimes because we have listeners that are architects and some listeners that are not architects. Mm-hmm. So we try to reach out this public as well. And we try to, because sometimes people just think, architects just do pretty drawings. Mm. And to understand that the research go to this level is quite interesting.
Yeah, we did a number of mock-ups on the site where we had we tested different glazes. It wasn't the first thing that we imagined.
So it's not just digital. Even on site, you tested.
Oh yeah, and it was the on-site testing where we realized that we do not. You know, we do not need to and we should not add colour to this building. And some of the very early renders that we did, we'd imagined that the facade was made of copper. And that would have been way too bright, too crass, and didn't speak of the tradition of ceramics. So there was a lot going
for it. I cannot imagine that being made of other material.
No, it was just an early idea, and it was a wrong idea. But it was about colour. You know, it took us getting to know the site and becoming familiar with it at different times of day and evening to realise how to maximise the potential.
How long it took to build this building from the moment that you start meeting with Antonio Mexia till start building?
I would say it probably took 4, possibly 5 years, because there was a period in the during construction where it was halted for a while. You know, there are all sorts of complexities that there always are on building projects. You know, it wasn't straightforward, but it was a hugely pleasurable experience.
And you mentioned quite a few times that you have this proximity with site. How long? So you go every month or every 2 months? So it seems to me that you have a really close relation.
Yeah, I mean, we went a lot in the beginning, and then obviously when it's on site. And it's just you need to get to know the place. You need to feel it.
And now that the museum is alive already, I think it has 6 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember to be on the 5th anniversary, by the way, of the building, because every time they make a birthday, so they make special events.
Yeah.
So it's also a time that people even come more to this mm-hmm. to this place. And I'm wondering, how do you feel after all these years? What do you think that you... So your goals were all achieved, or you have more goals achieved than you...
I think, you know, as an architect, you're always your worst critic. But I think that what we set out to do in creating a museum that really belonged to the city, that belonged to everybody who passed by it, who walked over it, who went inside it, that created a new sense of place and destination along the waterfront that really did help deal with this kind of paradox of the waterfront being cut off from the city. I think we succeeded really well in that.
What has the MAD project taught you about architecture?
I guess it's what you just alluded to. It's the importance of taking your time to get to know a place and resisting decision-making until you really understand where you are, where you're building, who you're building for, what's the purpose, what's the mission.
And at this point, what do you think are the problems that architects should be committed to right now to build better cities? You, of course, with this building, it feels like it's very important to you, to your office, to be committed to not just making a building, but how can you do with a project allow to build a place where people can connect, be together, so more than just a building, that building can somehow expand to public space?
I think it's about how do you find and then how do you express social purpose in a building? Because there's no other discipline really that is about everything. Architecture is about everything. It's about...
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's about creativity. It's about engineering. It's about politics. It's about economics. It's about regulations. You know, it's about culture. It's about identity. Everybody, everywhere in the world, experiences a building every moment of their life. I mean, it's so ubiquitous.
It's the moment we wake up.
Yes, huh? And so the kind of responsibility, if you like, that I think we have as architects is to make that experience as uplifting and pleasurable and comfortable as you can.
You were telling me on off that you will come back soon to Portugal. And I was wondering if we're going to see more projects of you in Portugal.
Well, I would love to do more projects in Portugal. I would absolutely love to. So if there's anybody listening who's thinking of commissioning something or having a competition, we're certainly up for it.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Amanda. I just feel bad that listeners cannot see your face because honestly, you speak with so much passion. I don't know if it's about all your projects, but it feels like this project has a special place.
Yeah, and Lisbon has a special place in my heart, for sure.
Yeah, for sure, this building allow this relationship with Lisbon get closer.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Amanda.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
The Brainstorm Group decided to join the podcast No País dos Arquitetos, in the country of architects, committed to developing products for building a more sustainable future side by side with architects. If you like this episode, you can find out more about this project at Public Newspaper and on ArcDaily website. You can share, subscribe, and listen to other conversations on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review and help us to promote Portuguese architecture. The musical themes on this podcast were composed by Bruno Ferreira and Diogo Chaves. The sound design is made by Joana Rodrigues. See you next week.